Okay, it's time we got started. Does everybody have a handout? If you don't have one, it's entitled The Herodians, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. Do you have this handout? If you don't have it, raise your hand and we'll get one to you. There's one. There we go. And we got plenty. You'll notice on the front of this, it's the latest information from the New Bible Dictionary edition, 1971. Latest edition. No, I suspect there are many editions since then. They seem to put one out every few years. That's the year I was gifted by my in-laws with that Bible and Bible Dictionary, and it's been very useful to me. Now, I've excerpted a few things from it about these three groups of people in Jesus' time that he encountered in his teachings and in his travels, and we're going to look at that this morning. The reading of a dictionary is a little bit stilted sometimes, and as you read that, but there's several bits and pieces of information you'll pick up as you go through this that'll be useful to you when you read in the Gospels about Jesus talking to the Pharisees or talking to the Sadducees. This gives you some information about what they believed, why they were different, where they came from. That's always useful material. So digest this, not during our lesson this morning, but when you get home and you're reading the Gospels and you run across one of these names, then you can see what it was. We'll talk about what they believed later on this morning. Teaching in the synagogues is the material we're going to look at today. And teaching in the temple was very similar, of course, just a bigger audience. But we'll look at that in a minute. I hope you're progressing in your studies of the Gospels. We challenged you to read all the way through the four Gospels every month, if you will, or at least during the 3 months that we're studying this particular study. I just finished Mark on my second time through, so I think I'm on schedule halfway through the month. Well, it's a little past halfway through the month. Today's the 20th. I've got to hump it a little bit, I guess, to get through Luke and John in the rest of this month. But I know that several of you are doing that, and I appreciate it very, very much. And you will benefit from it. Of course, when we get to the final exam and there's this big test, you'll benefit from it too. But I'm not going to administer the test. Jesus will administer the test and the judgment, so you can look forward to that. But you do need, all kidding aside, you do need to know what's in the Gospels, because you're going to teach people about what you believe and why you believe in Jesus and why you follow him. And so we've been looking at some verses that are useful in that regard at the start of our class. And one in Matthew, in the middle of a discussion with his disciples, some instructions that he was giving them, he gave them this particular set of declarations. Let's stand and read that together, please, out loud. Jesus said, "Whoever acknowledges me before men, I will also acknowledge him before my Father in heaven. But whoever disowns me before men, I will disown him before my Father in heaven." Thank you. Please be seated. What does it mean to acknowledge Jesus? What? Well, in the older versions of it, it does confess me before God, and I'll confess, or before men, and I'll confess him before God. But confess, what does that mean? We talk about this verse as supporting the idea that we must confess Christ, okay?
But to say that we believe
okay, that he believes, that we believe he is who he says he is. That's what an acknowledgement is, that you come to the agreement with some statement that someone's made. You acknowledge the truth of what they've said. And so that's what we're talking about here. Can you think of a New Testament example of an acknowledgement of Jesus as who he is? Who said that? Who gave you a good pattern? Peter did. What did Peter say? Stephen did too. But what did Peter say? What? We believe that you are the Christ or the Messiah, the Son of the living God. That's the confession is. And what does it mean to disown Christ? Did anybody ever do that? Now here we go to Peter again. What did Peter say? Who asked him? At the trials, one of the servant girls came and said, "You also are a Galilean. You must have been with him." And what did Peter say? "Sure I was." No. What did he say? He said, "I never knew the guy. I don't have anything to do with him." That's disowning. And so we have to be careful in life that we don't make a mistake like that. What was his motivation for doing that? He felt threatened, didn't he, by those whole circumstances, and he was afraid. He didn't understand exactly everything that was happening. The apostles were really confused. Jesus kept telling them what was going to happen, but they just didn't understand it. And so he was, their excuses, perhaps, for his behavior. And when he realized what he had done, what did he do? He went out and wept bitterly. Yes. Do you suppose Peter felt like this verse might apply to him? You suppose he wondered about what Jesus thought of him after that? And so, where do we see Jesus reassuring him that everything's okay ultimately? Right at the end of the Gospel of John, you see Jesus talking with them, and he asked Peter three times, what? Do you love me? Yes, and so Peter got back into God's good graces with his repentance in that matter. But it's important that we explain to people that you can't go through life secretly believing in Jesus and not confessing him before those that you live with and those you work with and those you go to school with. It has to be apparent, doesn't it, that we are who we are and we're Christians following Christ. Any other comments about that? Okay, today we're going to talk about the synagogue. We've already gone through some of these synagogue scenes, and we talked about it earlier in connection with one or two occasions, but we're going to look at the rest of them this morning. Not all of them, but many of them. Jesus went through all the towns and villages teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom and healing every disease and sickness. It seemed to have been Jesus' goal to visit every city and village, every town and village. There weren't very many cities. And preach in every one of them, if he could. In Galilee, particularly, but in Judea and all of Israel. He tried to cover the entire territory. And if you follow his the recorded travels that he made, you see a good bit of that. If he spoke in all of their synagogues, there must have been dozens or hundreds of synagogues. Not every village had a synagogue, but of course he spoke and taught in all of them, all of the villages. But those that had synagogues, he spoke there because that's where the faithful assembled on the Sabbath to study God's Word. And we have maybe 8 or 10 examples in the Gospels of these interactions in the synagogues. But the ones that we have tend to be places where there was some sort of conflict arose. And so you don't get the feeling that most of these synagogue encounters were good ones. I'm sure they were. He was welcomed. Why was he welcomed in all of these villages and towns? The healing was a big motive, wasn't it? They brought him everybody who was sick, those who were infested with demons, those who had been injured, maybe had birth defects, And he healed them all. And so they were very grateful for that, and he was welcomed in almost every place he went. So the ones that we read about are ones where there were conflicts and problems, but there were probably many, many more where there were no problems. Kind of keep that in mind. Don't get the wrong impression as you're reading, because the ones that the gospel writers record are the ones where there were some critical things came up from which we can learn. So that's the important thing. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Why was that? There's some Old Testament prophecies about that, that the shepherd was mistreating the sheep, and that's over in Ezekiel, isn't it? And that they were not feeding them properly, and the sheep were scattered, and there were all kinds of problems because the leaders of Israel were not taking care of the sheep. And so he noticed that in his interaction with the people. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." He said that same thing on another occasion. Do you remember where it was? In the fourth chapter of John. The woman at the well, she went back, told the population. They were coming out, and Jesus said something like this on that occasion too, didn't he, to his disciples about the harvest. The Samaritans were harvest as well as the Israelites. But anyway, this gives you something of the context of this particular verse. Can you imagine, do you know what went before and what comes after? That's going to be important in our study in a few weeks as we look at some of these other lessons. They didn't have chapter and verse, so they learned where things were by context. What follows this? Anybody remember? I'm reading. Where are we? We're in Matthew 9. What happens in Matthew 10? What? Sending out of the 12 and selecting the 12. They're listed in the beginning of the next chapter, and then he sends them out. So that's the context of it. So they're going with him, of course, up to this point, but he also sends them out on their own on occasion. All right. He went, and the first one is a familiar one because I think you've heard many sermons about this. He went to Nazareth. Nazareth is his what? Hometown. That's where he grew up. That's where he was a kid. That's where he went to school. That's where his family had many friends. And they all knew him, and they all knew Joseph and Mary. And so he was in Nazareth, where he'd been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. So what does that tell you? He went to synagogue with everybody else on the Sabbath. That's where you would find him and that, of course, is a lesson you've heard many times about her being faithful in the assembly. He stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place, and he read to them. I want to point out that when someone read the scriptures, they read it standing, like we just did a while ago. The reading of the scriptures was done standing up. This was the Jewish traditional way of doing this and the way they did it then. And then when he got through reading it, he's going to sit down to expound upon it, to teach. So they taught sitting down. I don't have a chair up here today. I guess I need... Okay, so that's the way they did it anyway. Now, what did he read? He read Isaiah. Anybody know where this verse of Scripture is? When you get to a verse of Scripture in the Gospels, look at the footnote, see where it is, go look, make sure that it's right. Where is it in Isaiah? We can go by chapter and verse. Isaiah 61, isn't it? It's the first few verses of Isaiah 61. And it's one that all of the Jews recognized as being about whom? The Messiah. Yeah, this is a messianic verse. All right. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he's anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. So he's ready to teach now, and everybody's watching him. He began by saying to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." What did that mean? What's he telling them sort of indirectly? That he's the Messiah. That's what that means. He doesn't say it outright. Now, you'll find later on in his ministry, he's hesitant to tell anybody or to let anybody let it be known that he's the Messiah. He tells the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, that he's the one she's talking to. But it isn't something he generally did, but he does it to his hometown folks. Why? Why would he tell them and he didn't want everybody else to know? That's right. They knew him from when he was a little baby, and it would be most likely that they would respond well to that information and be proud of him. I mean, did you ever go back to your hometown? And can you go back? I mean, you hear stories about that. The sheriff's still looking for me. All right? Can you go back? Or is that not a good idea? It's not a good idea. Why? big news that you grew up there, huh? Okay, well, the reaction here is kind of interesting. Notice what happened. All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. He's reading Isaiah, of course, and then they get to thinking about this. Who is this? Isn't this Joseph's son? And Jesus hears a murmur. I think it doesn't record it in the Gospels, but you can see that the ideas change in the audience. There's sort of a murmur that, wait a minute, what does this verse in Isaiah mean? And what did he just say? And so the crowd sort of changes on him. I'm sure he senses that. And he says, "Surely you will quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.'" Did he ever hear that? When? On the cross, they said, "If you're the Son of God, then come down off the cross." And so, "Physician, heal yourself." Where's Gary Irwin when we need him? There. Does anyone ever say, "Physician, heal yourself," to you? Haven't heard it, huh? Yeah, would you take this therapy if it was offered to you? Okay, so but anyway, a physician heals other people. Can you heal yourself? And of course, they know he's healed others. He hasn't demonstrated it much in Nazareth. Do here in your hometown what we've heard that you did in Capernaum. Capernaum's just up around the edge of the lake a bit, northeast of there. I tell you the truth, he continued, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years. And there was a severe famine throughout the land. Well, that's obviously true. There are many widows in any group at any time, but especially they were in trouble like everybody else was during a famine, weren't they? And so Elijah was sent where? Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow of Zarephath in the region of Sidon. That's further north of there and outside of Israel. Why was he sent up there? Who was looking for him during the time of the drought? Jezebel and Ahab. They were looking for him because he was the one who had declared there would be a drought and he couldn't stay in Israel, so he went north. But then the widow was taken care of. You remember the story? What did they do for the widow? She was going to bake the last of her bread and oil and make a cake, and she and her son were going to die. That was all they had to eat. And what happened?
Never ran out.
They had food from then on. Okay. There were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha. That's Elijah's follower, wasn't he? Elisha the prophet, yet no one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. And what happened to the crowd at that point? The prophets weren't even welcome in Israel, were they? They went and did their work elsewhere. And so they were really angry with him at that point, so much so that they were ready to do what to him? Can you imagine such a turn of events? Be careful when you go home. You never know how it's going to play out in your own hometown. All right, they took him to the brow of the hill and were going to throw him off the cliff. And I don't know if there was any supernatural activity going on here, but he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. So now there's one occasion in which his audience turned against him. But it's a special kind of thing that happened in his hometown. We'll see some more. A woman was in the synagogue who had been crippled by a spirit for 18 years. She was bent over, could not straighten up at all. And when Jesus saw her, he called her forward and said to her, "Woman, you're set free from your infirmity." So there, remember what he read about from Isaiah? What is the Messiah going to do? He's going to heal the sick and free the captives. Remember that? I just set the prisoners free. So he's going to do both to this woman, as we'll see. "You're set free." And he put his hands on her, and immediately she straightened up and praised God. Now, somebody reacted negatively to this one. Who was it? Who's the synagogue ruler? Do we have a synagogue ruler in our congregation here? No, we don't, do we? Ken, you're not the ruler, are you? No, he's not the ruler. And so we don't operate that way, but there was one person in charge of the synagogue, and you'll see some miracles that were, or at least one miracle that happened to the synagogue ruler. I think it was in Capernaum, but anyway, his daughter was healed by Jesus. But this is a situation where the synagogue ruler looks at this and says, "This is not right." He was indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. And he said to the people, "There are 6 days for work, so come and be healed on those days, not on the Sabbath." What is he implying? Healing is what? Work. Yeah. Well, it would be, and it is for Gary too, I guess. Healing is work. But you wouldn't think that it would be looked at that way in this circumstance. And Jesus said this, by his reaction to it, this does not violate the work laws for the Sabbath, healing. So here's an objection by one person and probably some followers. The Lord answered him, "You hypocrites." Now there was just one man, I thought. But he's talking about more than one. The ruler of the synagogue evidently had a group of followers. "Doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it out to give it water? Then should not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has kept bound for 18 long years?" You see, she's a prisoner. And that term is used in a variety of ways when we think about Jesus setting the prisoners free. Shouldn't she be set free on the Sabbath day from what bound her? That's much more important than leading your ox to water on the Sabbath. But you got to give it a drink of water, don't you? Or bring the water to it somehow or other. And that would be more work, you see, to carry a bucket of water to the ox than it would be to unloose the ox and carry it and lead it out to the water. When he said this, all of his opponents were humiliated. Now, that's a good reaction. They should be, shouldn't they? We agree with that. But the people were delighted with all the wonderful things he was doing. So that's another kind of reaction that he got in the synagogues. Suppose they would remember that. Now, when you read your handout about the Pharisees, you'll see down in there the meticulous way in which they examined all of the laws in the law of Moses and set out all of the guidelines as to how you should live on the Sabbath so that you don't violate this work problem. So there are things you can do and things you can't do, and they made those rules and they insisted that everybody else follow them. Of course, not everybody did. But that was what they wanted. But the people responded in a positive way here. Now another time, he went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there, and we read this one a couple of weeks ago. You remember it? What did he do? This is recorded also in Luke, and so you can, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three record this one. And so the man with the shriveled hand was there, and everybody was watching now to see if he's going to heal on the Sabbath. He's already been warned. Don't do that. But you can see his reaction here. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, and that becomes important in the rest of our story this morning. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. And Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." That part of the story reads much the same in all three of the accounts. And it's obviously the same event. Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" And they remained silent. Why didn't they give him an answer? Well, the obvious answer isn't the answer they were looking for, is it? Do good or do evil? Well, on the Sabbath, if you're going to do anything, do good. But their view was you shouldn't do anything. Okay, but that was a rule they had made. That's not what Moses had said. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. This is Jesus. How does he know what's in their hearts? He knows the hearts, doesn't he? In a way that we have great difficulty in understanding. I know some of your hearts. I think I do. Good people. And the more, you can't know anything about someone's heart unless you're with them for a while. I certainly know about Gail's heart. And she knows about mine. Is it hard? Hard-hearted, or is it hard to know about the heart? Pardon me? Crafty, okay. No, but the idea is that you have to be with somebody to know, but Jesus knew almost instantly. He could tell, it was obvious from the glare on their faces that they didn't want him to do anything. And he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Now, the other versions of this in the other Gospels say they went away thinking about what they could do to Jesus, but this one spells it out. The Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. That's pretty angry, aren't they? I mean, they're not just going to put him in jail. They want to get rid of him. You can see why Jesus was mad at them. If that's their attitude about healing somebody, whether it's on the Sabbath or any other day. So here we have the Pharisees and the Herodians. Now, I think most of us know a little bit about the Pharisees, but who are the Herodians? Well, the Herodians are those who were somehow connected with whom? Herod. Who's Herod? Well, when Jesus was born, Herod was the one that wanted to kill all the babies. Really nice guy. And to try to get Jesus at his birth. Of course, it wasn't Herod, it was Satan who instigated that whole interaction. But then Herod was followed by another Herod and another Herod. And then at the time of this, we're talking about Herod Antipas, Herod the Tetrarch. And so the Herodians... How would you read the Herodians? do they favor Herod, you suppose? They were the ones who were willing to live with Herod as, I mean, they would get by somehow in Israel. They wanted Herod to go ahead and be king, and we'll manage somehow or other. It was a political ploy on their part, wasn't it, to try to compromise with the Romans who were ruling. And so these are the political connections. Now, the Pharisees are at the extreme opposite end of the scale here. Pharisees are, as we've seen, meticulous about their obedience to the law of Moses, and they were the legalists, really, in religious matters. And so they were very, very conservative, and the Herodians at the other extreme would be very, very liberal, and the two very seldom had anything to do with one another. But here they're plotting together. Why would the Pharisees go with the Herodians to get rid of Jesus? The Pharisees couldn't. Well, the Herodians couldn't either, but what did the Herodians have that the Pharisees didn't have? They had the political connections, you see. And so now they're thinking about how can we get him? And you know, they were looking for some reason to accuse him. That was the other thing that came up again and again. Would Jesus misspeak? Would he say something that they could accuse him of? And when they in the trials, you'll recall, they couldn't find anything that made any sense. They just had false witnesses was about all they had to work with. And ultimately, what did they condemn him for? He said he was king, the Messiah. And that's blasphemy in their view. That's all they could ever come up with, but it turned out that what he said was actually true, not false. All right. Now, Matthew 22 is a series, beginning in the middle of the chapter, is a series of encounters between Jesus and these groups. As they come down, this is near the end of his ministry, and they come down toward the crucifixion, they're going to try to trap him. And so they send wave after wave of attackers, really, in sort of a legalistic, academic way, to try to find something to use as a threat and as a reason for condemning and killing him. So the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Yeah, because they've got the connections, you see. So, teacher, they said, now notice how they butter him up. I find this, I'm sure these words stuck in their craw as they said it, but they had to say it because they didn't want to give away what the end result was going to be. Teacher, they said, we know you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. So they set him up. Now, you're going to have to answer in connection with the way in which people are looking at you. Tell us then, what's your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Boom, there's the big question. And it was a conflict for the Jews, paying taxes. They hated to pay taxes. And you know the tax collectors? And that's another group of people that collaborated with the Romans in collecting these taxes. They were hated by the Jews. And so, is it wrong? Well, in their view, it was, wasn't it? And so they want Jesus to say, it's wrong to pay taxes to Caesar, and then what could they say? Well, the Herodians can say, okay, he's crossed the line, and he's advocating rebellion against Caesar, and therefore we have reason to kill him, right? Well, Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Why are they hypocrites? So yeah. They don't care what Jesus asks as long as he says something they can use to kill him. And so they're not really interested in the question as such. It's one, and in fact, it's a question they debated over and over again, they couldn't quite reach an agreement about it. And they didn't want to say anything out loud, because if you said it's wrong to pay taxes to Caesar, Caesar might get angry, mightn't he? So, or his employees might get angry. Show me the coin used for paying the tax. And they brought him a denarius. And he asked them, that's a coin. Whose portrait is this and whose inscription? And Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And when they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. That wasn't the answer they wanted, was it? That one. Do we live in that sort of dichotomy? Things that belong to God and things that belong to the state of Texas and things that belong to the United States, and you pay income taxes and so on. Yes, we do, don't we? And so this frees us up to distribute from our blessings the things that belong. And actually, it's not so odious in our, well, it depends on how you look at it, in our situation, because in a republic like ours, the people have a say as to where the money's spent and that sort of thing. And it doesn't always work, but it's not perfect, but it's not bad. And so this fits the way people live. Okay. Now, the same day, the Sadducees, who say there's no resurrection, now they came at him with a different kind of question, a religious question. And I find this one is most amusing. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow, have children for him. Now, there were seven brothers among us. The first one married, this is hypothetical, obviously, isn't it? I doubt if this ever happened in reality. The first one married and died. Since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second, the third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? They could have posed this question with just two brothers. You realize that. And which of the two would be? And the funny thing about the seven is that when you get to the third or fourth brother trying to marry this black widow woman who kills her spouse, I don't think you could get the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh husband to sign up. It just wouldn't work. She's poisoning the food, or what's she doing that they all die in sequence like this? All right. Pardon me? After they're married. Yeah, they seem to be in good health before they married. Okay, so there's the puzzle. Whose wife is she? Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm sure they debated this because they don't believe in the resurrection. And in the little squib, even though it's several paragraphs, but you'll read down in there, they believe that when a person dies, he's like Rover dead all over. His soul and everything's gone. Now they do that because the resurrection isn't taught by Moses as it is by the prophets. Certainly beginning with David and others, you'll find references to the soul surviving death, but they didn't believe it. They believed only in the Torah, and so they said it's not true. So now here's this puzzle. She's married to all seven. And which one's her real husband? Well, and so, of course, Jesus has an answer. You're in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Does that mean you won't know your husband or wife in heaven? He didn't say that, did he? But he did say that, and why is there no need for marriage? There's no procreation, that's right. You're not going to have children in heaven, and so there's no need for it. And certainly, it's a different environment, a different situation, and so don't worry about it, he says. We don't know the details about heaven, but this is an interesting clue. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? Now, of course, he's going to have to quote the Torah for this, because that's all the Sadducees believe in. But on the other hand, he's really thrusting a dagger in them and twisting the blade, because they've read it again and again and again. They live and breathe the scriptures, the Torah especially, and you read what's in the what what Moses said? God said to you, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Where did he say that? At the burning bush. I think that was mentioned this morning in the sermon, wasn't it? That's what he said. And he told Moses that. And Moses wrote it down in Exodus 3. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Those men are not dead. They're physically dead, but spiritually, their souls live on. That's what Jesus is explaining to them. And our time's almost gone, but we've got room for one or two more. While the Pharisees, now, coming after that was a question we skipped over because we've already looked at it before, was a question about what, they came at him with another one of these tricky questions, what's the greatest commandment? And what did he say the greatest commandment was? Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbors yourself. And so they that came in between the one we just read and this one. But then he poses a puzzle to them. What do you think about Christ? Whose son is he? The son of David, they replied. How do they know that? God had promised David, if you go back and read, back in the at the time that Solomon became king, wasn't it? But David was promised that his son would sit on his throne and that there would be an eternal kingdom that would not end and that sort of thing. So they know that. I mean, they read that and they understood it. He said to them, how is it then that David speaking by the Spirit, what does it mean to be speaking by the Spirit? That means David was inspired, right? So this has to be something that the Spirit of God told David to write. And where did he write it? For he says, the Lord said to my Lord, set at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If David then calls him Lord, how can he be a son? That seemed to pose a puzzle to them, and no one asked him any more questions after that. Where was the quote about David? Psalms 110. First verse, as a matter of fact, I think, wasn't it? So, how is it that he's Lord, and yet he's the son of David? Well, he's the Messiah. See? And the crowds had been calling Jesus the son of David. Now, that's an interesting thrust that he puts at the end of his argument with all of these people. They never got anything that they could use in a legal sense with him. So, there you have Jesus talking with smaller groups. We're going to look at Jesus next week talking to a huge crowd at the Sermon on the Mount. This is about the life and teachings of Jesus. So we're going to look at some of the details. And thank you for your participation this morning. Be sure and continue to read the Gospels.